And good morning. You're listening to 88.7 WHCL-FM, Clinton, New York. My guest this morning is Phyllis Bendis. Did I pronounce your last name correctly?
You did. Oh, exactly right.
Okay, and she'll be joining us to speak about the drones, the unmanned hunter-killer Reaper drones. I know that you've written a few books. Do any of your books deal with this subject, or has this just been
art? Well, I've written about the U.S. wars in Afghanistan and the U.S. wars in Iraq. So when you talk about those wars, you pretty much have to talk about drones, because that's an increasing part of how the U.S. is waging war. It's now, of course, expanded. But in those wars already, we've seen the reliance on drones, usually without a pilot, orchestrated and operated, in many cases, in the United States. There's these horrific stories of drone pilots who operate their, what they call, unmanned drones across the world from an air base in Arizona. And they send their drones out to find and kill people who are on a U.S. list. They call it the kill or capture list, which really means it's an assassination list. And if they miss, they miss. If they make their right shot, they make their right shot, and then they go home for dinner because they're not fighting a war. They're playing video games, from all intents and purposes, except these video games have a real bomb at the end of it and real people under those bombs.
How does the administration decide who will be on the list?
Well, this is very secretive. What we do know is that it's based on intelligence information that comes to the U.S. military and the CIA. Remember, many of the drones are run by CIA programs, which are not acknowledged, are not under any kind of supervision from Congress or the American people. The cost isn't known. The consequences are not known. And this false deniability of the CIA denying what everyone knows exists means there's absolutely no accountability. But the question of how the drones operate and what they mean in these wars is based fundamentally on this list. And the list is made up of names of people who someone in theater, as they like to say, meaning in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, in Yemen, in Somalia, in increasing numbers of countries around the world, somebody tells someone who tells someone who tells someone in the U.S. military hierarchy or the CIA's unofficial, unacknowledged secret hierarchy that so-and-so is a member of Al-Qaeda or so-and-so is involved in bomb-making. Sometimes, I'm sure it's true. Sometimes, it has absolutely no basis, in fact, and the person talking about it is someone who's had a land dispute with that person or who has had a family or a clan-based contradiction or argument with that person that perhaps goes back even generations. Sometimes it's personal animus. Sometimes it's for personal gain. Somebody wants somebody killed, and this is a good way to do it. The problem is because we don't have sufficient engagement in these countries, with plenty of people who speak the local languages, who live there for long periods of time, who live with people rather than behind huge military protection, which of course doesn't provide real protection, but does serve to keep U.S. soldiers, U.S. diplomats away from real people, we have really no idea if these accusations are true or not. We're forced to rely on confidential informants. And when you rely on confidential informants, there's something inherently flawed in the process. So we don't know. There's no public acknowledgement of who's on this list. We only know one of them, the American who was killed in Yemen a couple of weeks back, and because there was a court case. His father, he's an American citizen, and it was known that the U.S. was trying to target him and assassinate him. It was known he was on this so-called kill or capture list, and there was a court case in which his father tried to say, you have no right to put my son, an American citizen, on this list. And the case was thrown out of court on the grounds that the father did not have standing to challenge his son's place on this list. And sure enough, 2 weeks ago, Ella Lackey was killed in an American military attack.
And when they say that he didn't have standing, they mean that because he's not the one being targeted?
Exactly.
Okay.
In theory, they were saying Alaki can raise it himself, but he'd have to come here and subject himself to being on this kill and capture list to do so.
Mm-hmm.
But the other side of that case was that there was an absolute refusal to make public the process by which anyone gets put on that list and the protections, if any, that are in place to make sure that it's not abused. The very idea that the U.S. has such a list is appalling. I mean, it's a complete violation of international law that says that people cannot be targeted somewhere else. You know, this claim, when the U.S. says, well, we're at war, we decided to call it a war, and we decided that all of the protections that have grown up so painfully in the last century over how to do warfare. I mean, it's a horrific thought, but it is a reality that there are laws of war. And among other things, the laws of war say that you can't just go kill somebody somewhere else because you think that someday he might attack you. And in this case, the U.S. is saying none of that applies. Our field of war is the whole world. So anywhere we say there is a combatant, and anyone we define as a combatant can be assassinated whenever, wherever, by whatever means we want, and we don't have to account to anyone. So it's a very serious set of violations of international law, and the U.S. is carrying it out simply on the basis of assertion. We say that this is a war, and it's a new kind of war, and it's a war in which we have the right to kill or capture anyone in the world.
So is this the mentality that Professor Banks is using? I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he teaches at Syracuse University School of Law and the School of Counterterrorism.
I'm not aware of his work.
Okay. He said that these are perfectly legal and they're not against international law, using the drones. So I'm...
Yeah, you know, a drone is an instrument. A drone is a weapon. There's a few weapons that have been explicitly outlawed in international law, nuclear weapons most efficiently and most importantly, but also, for example, white phosphorus used in a civilian or populated area is illegal. Cluster bombs are illegal, and it has taken long fights, years-long fights, to get these international treaties, some of which the U.S. has refused to sign, like the treaty banning landmines, for instance. The U.S., you know, for years refuses to sign that treaty. Actually, I don't know if President Obama has signed it. It's possible that it has changed. But for years, it was a scandal that the U.S. was refusing to sign this crucial treaty designed to protect civilians from death and amputation of limbs from these terrible weapons. So there are specific weapons that have been banned. Drones are not by themselves illegal. They are a weapon of war. But the question of the use of a drone targeted in a third country by one country against a national of a different country without regard for what the civilian consequences might be, it's the act that's illegal. It's not necessarily the instrument that's the illegality. So the professor is right when he says drones are not illegal. So far, that's true. I hope that changes. But so far, that's true. What's illegal is targeting individual civilians who we decide to call a combatant for assassination. Even President Bush once, for a fleeting moment, criticized Israel for its open policy of targeted assassinations that it has used over and over again against Palestinians, primarily in the occupied Palestinian territory, on occasion further afield in the 1970s and early 80s. But now the U.S. is simply carrying out that identical policy. We decide who should be assassinated, and we go after them and target them. These are not acts of self-defense at the moment that somebody is actually building a bomb. This is in anticipation This is not a preemptive strike to stop somebody from an imminent attack. This is a preventive strike, which the U.S. used to go to war against Iraq in 2003 illegally, and is now using against individuals illegally.
One of my friends who had called in beforehand, because I can't take calls exactly while you're on here, had asked me to promote your Ending War in Afghanistan, a primer. She thought it was such a great book. If you'd like to just speak about that for a moment.
Oh, well, I'm glad that somebody thought it was useful. I did the book with my colleague David Wildman, who spends a lot of time in Afghanistan every year. The book is called Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan, a Primer, published by Interlink Books. And what it does is take up a series of FAQs. It's a series of frequently asked questions about the war. Who are we fighting? Why did we go to war? Was this really self-defense? What does the Taliban have to do with Al-Qaeda? All of those kinds of basic questions that are sometimes hard to sort out. And it's done as a separate set of questions, so you can kind of leaf through it and pick the questions that you find most interesting. You don't have to sort of read the entire book necessarily. And it's little and fits in your back pocket and sells for $10, so people like that.
Great. And people can find it just by going to any bookstore, or do you have a
website? You could ask your bookstore. That's always a good thing. Ask them to carry it. Mm-hmm. But you can also order it directly from the publisher, from Interlink, which is at interlinkbooks.com.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, can I ask you a couple more questions?
Sure. We just have, we have a few more minutes.
Thank you. I was just curious, which international laws are being violated through targeted assassination?
Well, it's in the Geneva Conventions, and, oh boy, I only know a few of the numbers by heart, which article. But one of the articles of the convention, it might be Article 49, it's either 33 or 49, speaks of collective punishment. And in that language, it says very clearly that no one can be punished for any act they did not personally commit, which goes to both the danger of so-called collateral damage, the killings of, you know, if you go after someone who's on your list, when they go into a house or into a car, the people in that car or in that house are likely to be killed or massively injured in a drone strike. So it becomes a kind of collective punishment because you know that ahead of time. It's not surprising. You may not know exactly who the people are, but it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
They are innocent. The other has to do with the question of trials. No one can be punished or executed without a trial. These are people who have had no trial, no opportunity to confront their accuser, no oversight, no judicial oversight, even if you say, well, you can't tell them because, you know, then we wouldn't be able to find them. Well, first of all, we don't know who they are. They, those people on the list.
Mm-hmm.
Who are they? Who put them on the list? How good is the evidence? Who oversees that evidence? We have no access, the judicial system in this country has no access to determine whether this is a legally bound process or not.
And when you say no one can be punished or executed without trial, that's also part of Geneva Convention or a different...
No, that's also in the Geneva Conventions. And again, I wish I knew them all by heart, but I don't.
And there's also provisions in the UN Charter, aren't there? That would
Absolutely. In the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which of course is not itself a charter, but is a guide for the world on the rights of every individual, the charter itself speaks of the rights of nations. So that's less likely. But the Universal Declaration of Human Rights speaks of the right to life, that no one can have their life taken away in that sense. The UN Charter is important because this is also a violation of Article 51, which is the crucial thing that the U.S. has long relied on to claim that its whole so-called global war on terror, the GWAT, one of my favorite acronyms because it sounds just like what it is, GWAT. The GWAT is a war, according to U.S. officials and U.S. laws. And it's based on the idea that because someone attacked us on September 11th of 2001, we have the right to go to war against anyone in the world, anywhere, for as long as we want, using whatever weapons we want, targeting whomever we want, at whatever cost, without anyone ever saying a word, because it's self-defense. The problem is, the UN Charter, which is vague about a number of things, is very clear about one thing, and that is that it's to go to war is only legal in two circumstances, one of which is when the Security Council decides, which certainly did not happen in this case. Mm-hmm. The other is in Article 51, where it talks about self-defense. Self-defense on September 11 included the horrific but absolutely legal effort to shoot down the third plane that was heading for Washington. It would have been the same against the second plane once it was clear what those planes were being used for. It's a horrific thought, but it would have saved huge numbers of lives. That's a reality. That would have been a legal act of self-defense. To go to war 3 weeks later against a country that had not attacked us, when none of the hijackers were Afghans, they were Saudis and Egyptians, our great allies at the time, they didn't live in Afghanistan, they lived in Hamburg. They didn't train in Afghanistan, they trained in Florida. They didn't go to flight school in Afghanistan, they went to flight school in Minnesota. So we had no right to go to war against Afghanistan because they were inspired by someone who was living there at the time. That's not what international law allows, and it's precisely to prevent this notion of people going to war anywhere in the world that they want. You know, look at the outrage that is going on this morning with the reported plot by someone in the Iranian government to supposedly assassinate a Saudi diplomat here in Washington, D.C. Now, we have no idea if any of this claim is true. Again, it's relying on an unidentified informant, a confidential informant, which makes everything very suspect. But look at the outrage at the idea of the way Eric Holder, the Attorney General, spoke of it this morning, or last night, I guess, when he talked about how outrageous it was that you have one government targeting the diplomat of another government by hiring someone from a third government to carry out an assassination in another country. That is pretty outrageous. That's what the U.S. is doing, not to diplomats, but to people whom we don't know who they are. We don't know what they're charged with. We don't know whether they're guilty of anything, whether they're about to commit a crime, whether they're about to carry out a military attack against a military installation or military people occupying her or his country. We don't know any of that. Mm-hmm. We don't know any of that.
And the Nuremberg principles, would that also apply?
Absolutely. The Nuremberg principles always apply. And in this case, you know, the question is that of who can be held accountable, the principle of accountability. And what was so important about Nuremberg, many things, but one of the things that was so important about Nuremberg was the insistence on a trial. There was pressure on the U.S. government at that time to simply hang some of the Nazi war criminals, and an understandable desire for revenge. Revenge is a very human notion. But the idea that governmental policies can legitimately be made on the basis of revenge, that's where you get into trouble. That's why you need international law, to shape a world where outrage and revenge does not create policies. That's why the use of drones, this cold-blooded, hands-off approach where there are no American casualties and therefore we don't hear about any casualties, is a very, very dangerous escalation in how we come to understand the wars that we are now entering into.
Thank you so much for taking the time to be with me this morning.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Bye.
Bye-bye.